The trail they left was broad and open. There had been no attempt to hide either their number or their direction. From the width of the trail and the impressions left by the footprints, Mennion concluded that at least several thousand men had passed this way a few days earlier. The footprints were gnome and troll, obviously part of the Northland hordes of the Warlock Lord. Elanon was certain now that a giant army was massing on the plains above Callahorn to begin a sweep through the Southland that would divide the free lands and their armies. The trail had become so obscured by the intermingling of constant additional parties into the main body that it was no longer possible to tell whether a small group might have detached itself. Shay or the sword could have been taken a different way at some point, and his friends would fail to catch it, continuing to follow the main army. They walked southward all day with only occasional periods of rest, intent on catching the huge column of men ahead before nightfall. The trail of the invading army was so apparent that Mennion merely glanced out of habit from time to time at the trampled earth. The barren plains of Strelaheim were replaced by green grasslands. To Flick, it almost seemed that they were going home again, and the familiar hills of Shady Vale might be just over the rise of the plains. The weather was warm and humid, and the terrain was considerably more friendly. They were still some distance from Callahorn, but it was clear that they were passing out of the bleakness of the Northland into the warmth and greenness of their home. The day passed quickly, and conversation between the travelers resumed. At Flick's urging, Alanon told them more about the Council of the Druids. He recounted in detail the history of man since the Great Wars, explaining how their race had progressed to its present state of existence. Mennion said little, content to listen to the druid and keep a close watch over the surrounding countryside. When they had begun the day's march, the sun had been bright and warm, and the sky clear. By mid-afternoon, the weather had changed abruptly, and the brightness of the sun was replaced by low-hanging gray rain clouds and an even more humid atmosphere that clung uncomfortably to the exposed skin. The air felt sticky and wet, and there was little doubt that a storm was approaching. They were near the southernmost boundaries of the impregnable forest by this time, and the jagged peaks of the Dragon's Teeth were visible in the dark horizon to the south. Still, there was no sign of the massive army traveling ahead of them, and Mennion was beginning to wonder how far south it might have already penetrated. They were not far now from the borders of Callahorn, which lay immediately below the Dragon's Teeth. If the Northland armies had already taken Callahorn, then the end had indeed come. The gray light of the afternoon dropped off sharply, and the sky closed over in sullen darkness. It was dusk when they first heard the ominous booming rising out of the night, echoing off the giant peaks ahead of them. Mennion recognized it at once. He had heard that sound before in the forests of the Anar. It was the sound of hundreds of gnome drums, their steady rhythm throbbing through the stillness of the humid air, filling the night with a sinister tension. The earth shook with the force of the beat, and all life had gone mute in awe and fear. Mennion could tell by the intensity of the drums that there were far more than they had encountered at the Pass of Jade. If the army of the Northland could be measured by the sound of those drums, then there must be thousands. As the three moved quickly ahead, the frightening sound enveloped them entirely, booming all around them in shuddering echoes. The gray clouds of late afternoon still masked the night sky, leaving the searching men shrouded in inky darkness. Mennion and Flick could no longer find the way alone, and the silent druid led them with uncanny precision into the rough lowlands below Paranor. No one spoke, each man frozen into watchful apprehension by the deathly booming of those gnome drums. They knew that the enemy camp was just ahead. Then the terrain changed abruptly from the low hills and scattered brush to steep slopes dotted with boulders and treacherous rock ledges. The sure-footed Al-Anon moved steadily ahead, his tall form unmistakable even in the near blackness, and the two Southlanders followed dutifully. Menyon estimated that they must have reached the smaller mountains and foothills just above the Dragon's Teeth, and that Al-Anon had chosen to come this way to avoid any chance encounters with members of the Northland Army. It was still impossible to tell where the enemy army was encamped, but from the sound of the drums it seemed as if they were right on top of it. The three dark shapes wound their way cautiously through the night for what must have been almost an hour, at times feeling their way blindly through the boulders and brush. Their clothes were scraped and torn, their exposed limbs scratched and bruised, but the silent druid did not slacken the pace or pause to rest. At the end of that long hour's time, he halted abruptly and turned to them, placing a warning finger over pursed lips. Then slowly, cautiously, he led them forward into a huge mass of boulders. For several minutes, the three climbed noiselessly upward. Suddenly, there were lights in the distance, dim, flickering yellow lights that came from burning fires. They crawled on hands and knees to the rim of the boulders. Upon reaching a tilted shelf of rock that sloped upward to the edge of the boulder cluster, they raised their heads slowly to the rim and peered breathlessly over. What they saw was awesome and terrifying. As far as the eye could see, stretching miles in all directions, the fires of the Northland Army burned in the night. They were like thousands of blazing yellow dots in the blackness of the plains, and moving busily about in their bright light were the dim shapes of wiry, gnarled gnomes and bulky, thick-limbed trolls. There were thousands of them, all armed, all waiting to descend on the kingdom of Callahorn. It was inconceivable to Menyon and Flick that even the legendary Border Legion could hope to stand against such a mighty force. It was as if the entire gnome and troll population had been gathered on the plains below. Al-Anon had avoided any chance encounters with scouts or guards by approaching along the edges of the Dragon's Teeth on the western borders, and now the three were perched in a crow's nest of boulders several hundred feet up from the army encamped below. From this height, the shocked Southlanders could see the entirety of the massive force assembled to invade their poorly defended homeland. The drums of the gnomes boomed out in steady crescendo as the men stared down, their eyes traveling from one end of the sprawled camp to the other in disbelief. For the first time, they understood fully what they were up against. Before, it had been only Al-Anon's words describing the invasion. Now they could see the enemy and judge for themselves. Now they could feel the desperate need for the mysterious Sword of Shannara, a need for the one power that could destroy the evil being who had caused this army to materialize and march against them. But now was already too late. For several long minutes, no one said anything as they stared down at the enemy encampment. Then Menyon touched Al-Anon on the shoulder and started to speak, but the druid clamped his hand quickly over the surprised Highlander's mouth and pointed toward the base of the slope on which they lay concealed. Menyon and Flick peered cautiously downward, and to their surprise, they made out the vague shapes of gnome guards patrolling near the base of their hiding place. Neither had believed the enemy would bother to place guards this far from the actual camp, but apparently they were taking no chances. Al-Anon motioned for the two to move back from the ledge of the boulders, and they quickly complied, following his lead as he inched his way down into the tall rocks. Once they had reached the bottom of the boulder cluster, safely away from the rim of the ledge, the druid huddled together with them in earnest counsel. "We have to be very quiet," he warned in a tense whisper. The sound of our voices would have echoed off the cliff face onto the plains from up there. Those gnome guards would have heard us. Menyon and Flick nodded in understanding. The situation is more serious than I thought, Alanon continued, his voice a hushed rasp in the gloom. It appears the entire Northland army has bunched at this one point to strike at Callahorn. Brona intends to crush any resistance from the Southland immediately, dividing the better prepared armies of the East and West so he can deal with them separately. The Evil One already holds everything north of Callahorn. Balinor and the others must be warned. He paused a moment, then turned expectantly to Menyon Lee.
I can't leave now, Menyon exclaimed heatedly. I've got to help you find Shay.
We haven't the time to argue the priorities of the situation, Alanon declared almost menacingly, one finger coming up like a dagger at the Highlander's face. If Balinor is not warned about the situation, Callahorn will fall, and the rest of the Southland will follow, including Lee. The time has come for you to start thinking about your own people. Shay is only one man, and right now there is nothing you can do for him. But there is something you can do for the thousands of Southlanders who face enslavement at the hands of the Warlock Lord if Callahorn should fall. Alanon's voice was so cold that Flick could feel the chills run up his spine. He could sense Menyon tensing expectantly, fearfully at his side. But the Prince of Lee kept silent in the face of this stinging reprimand. Druid and Prince faced one another in the darkness for several interminable minutes, their eyes locked in open anger. Then Menyon looked away abruptly and nodded shortly. Flick breathed an audible sigh of relief.
I'll go to Callahorn and warn Balinor, Menyon muttered, his voice still muffled with fury. But I'll be back to find you.
Do as you wish when you have found the others, replied Alanon coldly. However, any attempt to return through enemy lines would be foolhardy at best. Flick and I shall try to find out what has happened to Shay and the sword. We will not desert him, Highlander. I promise you.
Menyon looked back at him sharply, almost in disbelief, but the druid's eyes were clear and undisguised. He was not lying.
Keep close to these smaller mountains until you get past the enemy picket lines, the giant wanderer advised quietly. When you reach the Myrmidon River above Kern, cross there and enter the city before dawn. I expect the Northland army will march on Kern first. There is little chance the city can be successfully defended against a force of that size. The people should be evacuated and moved into Tirsis before the invaders can cut off their retreat. Tirsis is built on a plateau against the back of a mountain. Properly defended, it can withstand any assault for at least several days. That should be time enough for Durin and Dale to reach their homeland and return with the Elven army. Hendel should be able to offer some help from the Eastland. Perhaps Callahorn can be held long enough to mobilize and combine the armies of the three lands to strike back at the Warlock Lord. It is the only chance we have without the Sword of Shannara.
Menyon nodded in understanding and turned to Flick, extending his hand in a gesture of farewell. Flick smiled faintly and clasped the hand warmly.
Good luck to you, Menyon Lee.
Alanon came forward and placed a strong hand on the Highlander's lean shoulder.
Remember, Prince of Lee, we depend on you. The people of Callahorn must be made aware of the danger they face. If they falter or hesitate, they are lost, and with them, all of the Southland. Do not fail.
Menyon turned abruptly and moved like a shadow into the rocks beyond. The giant druid and the little veilman stood silently as the lean figure flitted agilely between the rocks and then disappeared from sight. They stood for a few minutes without speaking after he was gone, and then Alanon turned to Flick.
To us is left the task of finding out what has happened to Shay and the sword.
He spoke again in a lowered voice, sitting heavily down on a small rock. Flick moved closer to him.
I'm worried about even time as well. That broken standard we found back at the battlefield was his personal banner. He may have been taken prisoner, and if he has, the Elven army may hesitate to act until he has been rescued. They love him too dearly to take a chance with his life, even to save the Southland.
You mean the Elven people don't care what happens to the people of the Southland? Flick exclaimed incredulously. Don't they know what will happen to them should the Southland fall to the Warlock Lord?
It's not quite as simple as it seems, Alanon stated, sighing deeply. Those who follow Eventine understand the danger, but there are others who believe that the Elven people should stay out of the affairs of the other lands, unless they are directly attacked or threatened. With Eventine absent, the choice will not be so clear, and discussion of what is right and proper may delay any move by the Elven army until it is too late for them to help.
Flick nodded slowly, thinking of another time at Cullhaven when a bitter Hendel had reported much the same thing about the people of the Southland cities. It seemed incredible that people could be so undecided and confused in the face of such obvious danger. Yet Shay and he had been like that when they had first learned about Shay's birthright and the threat of the Skullbearers. It was not until they had seen one crawling, searching for them.
I've got to know what's happening in that camp.
Alanon's voice cut into Flick's thoughts with a sharp rasp of determination. He paused in thought a moment, staring at the little Veilman.
My young friend Flick.
He smiled faintly in the darkness.
How would you like to be a gnome for a little while?
Chapter 22. With Shay still missing somewhere north of the Dragon's Teeth, and Alanon, Flick, and Menyon in search of some definite sign of his whereabouts, the remaining four members of the now divided company of friends drew within sight of the great towers of the fortress city of Tirsis. It had taken them almost 2 days of constant travel, their hazardous journey through the lines of the Northland army further impeded by the formidable mountain barrier cutting off the Southland kingdom of Calahorn from the land of Paranor. The first day was long, but without incident, as the four wound southward through the forests adjoining the gnome-patrolled impregnable forest to reach the lowlands beyond, which formed the doorstep to the awesome Dragon's Teeth. The mountain passes were all carefully guarded by gnome hunters, and it seemed it would prove to be impossible to get past them without a fight. But a simple ruse lured most of the guards away from the entrance to the high, winding Kennen Pass, allowing the four an opportunity to get into the mountains. The difficult task of getting out again at the southern end was accomplished only after several gnomes were silently dispatched at a midpoint check camp, and 20 more were frightened into believing the entire border legion of Calahorn had seized the pass and was descending on the luckless sentries with every intention of killing them all. Hendel was laughing so hard when they finally reached the safety of the forests south of the Kennen Pass that all four were forced to pause momentarily until he could recover his composure. Durin and Dale looked doubtfully at one another, recalling the taciturn dwarf's grim attitude during the journey to Paranor. They had never seen him laugh at anything, and somehow it seemed out of character. They shook their lean faces in disbelief and glanced questioningly at Balinor. But the giant borderman only shrugged. He was an old friend to Hendel, and the dwarf's changeable character was well known to him. It was good to hear his laughter again. Now in the twilight of the early evening, with the sun's fading light a hazy purple and red in the vast horizon of the western plains, the four stood within sight of their destination. Their bodies were worn and sore, their normally keen minds numbed by lack of sleep and constant travel, but their spirits rose with unspoken excitement at the sight of the majestic city of Tirsis. They paused for an instant at the edge of the forests that ran south from the Dragon's Teeth through Callahorn. To the east was the city of Varfleet, which guarded the only sizable passage through the Mountains of Rhoom, a small range that lay above the fabled Rainbow Lake. The sluggish Myrmidon River wound its way through the forest at their backs above Tirsis. Westward lay the smaller island city of Kern, and the source of the river was farther west in the vast emptiness of the Strelaheim Plains. The river was broad at all points, forming a natural barrier against any would-be enemy and offering reliable protection for the inhabitants on the island. While the river ran full, which it did almost the year around, the waters were deep and swift, and no enemy had ever taken the island city. Yet while both Kern, surrounded by the waters of the Myrmidon, and Varfleet, nestled in the Mountains of Rune, seemed formidable and well-defended, it was the ancient city of Tirsis that harbored the Border Legion, the precision fighting machine that had for countless generations successfully guarded the borders of the Southland against invasion. It was the Border Legion that had always taken the brunt of any assault against the race of man, offering the first line of defense against an enemy invader. Tirsis had given birth to the Border Legion of Callahorn, and as a fortress it was without equal. The old city of Tirsis had been destroyed in the first War of the Races, but had been rebuilt and then expanded over the years until now it was one of the largest cities in all the Southland and by far the strongest city standing in the northern regions. It had been designed as a fortress capable of withstanding any enemy attack, a bastion of towering walls and jagged ramparts set on a natural plateau against the face of an unscalable cliff. Each generation of its citizens had contributed in the construction of the city, each making it more formidable. Over 700 years ago, the great outer wall had been built on the edge of the plateau, extending the boundaries of Tirsis as far as nature would permit on the bluff face. In the fertile plains below the fortress were the farms and croplands that fed the city, the dark earth nurtured and sustained by the life-giving waters of the great Myrmidon which ran east and south. The people had their homes scattered throughout the surrounding countryside, relying on the city's walled protection only in the event of invasion. For hundreds of years following the First War of the Races, the cities of Callahorn had successfully repelled assaults by unfriendly neighbors. None of the three had ever been seized by an enemy. The famed Border Legion had never been defeated in battle. But Callahorn had never faced an army the size of that sent by the Warlock Lord. The real test of strength and courage lay ahead. Balinor looked upon the distant towers of his city with mixed feelings. His father had been a great king and a good man, but he was growing old. For years he had commanded the Border Legion in its unceasing battle against persistent gnome raiders from the Eastland. Several times he had been forced to wage long and costly campaigns against the great Northland trolls when scattered tribes had moved into his land, intent on seizing its cities and subjugating its people. Balinor was the elder son and the logical heir to the throne. He had studied hard under his father's careful guidance, and he was well-liked by the people. People whose friendship could be won only through respect and understanding. He had worked beside them, fought beside them, and learned from them, so that now he could feel what they felt and look through their eyes. He loved the land enough to fight to hold it, as he was doing now, as he had been doing for a number of years. He commanded a regiment of the Border Legion, and they wore his personal insignia, a crouched leopard. They were the key unit of the entire fighting force. For Balinor, holding their respect and devotion was more important than anything. He had been gone from them for months now, gone, by his own choosing, to a self-imposed exile of travel with the mysterious Al-Anon and the company from Cullhaven. His father had asked him not to go, pleaded with him to reconsider his decision. But he had already decided. He was not to be swayed, even by his father. His brow furrowed, and a strange feeling of gloom settled into his mind as he looked down on his homeland. Unconsciously, he raised one gloved hand to his face, the cold chainmail tracing the line of the scar that ran down the exposed right cheek to his chin. "Thinking about your brother again?" Hendel asked, although it was not so much a question as a statement of fact. Balinor looked over at him, momentarily startled, then nodded slowly. "You've got to stop thinking about that whole business, you know," the dwarf stated flatly. "He could be a real threat to you if you persist in thinking of him as a brother, and not as a person." "It is not so easy to forget that his blood and mine make us more than sons born to the same father," the borderman declared gloomily. "I cannot ignore nor forget such strong ties." Durin and Dale looked at each other, unable to comprehend what the two were talking about. They knew that Balinor had a brother, but they had never seen him, and had heard no mention of him since they had begun the long journey from Cullhaven. Balinor noticed the baffled looks on the faces of the two elven brothers, and shot a quick smile in their direction. "It's not as bad as it might seem," he assured them calmly. Hendel shook his head hopelessly and lapsed into silence for the next few minutes. "My younger brother Palance and I are the only sons of Rule Buckhanna, the King of Callahorn," Balinor volunteered, his eyes wandering back toward the distant city as if looking for another time. "We were very close while growing up. As close as you two. As we got older, we developed different ideas about life. Different personalities, as all individuals must, brothers or not. I was the elder. I was next in line to the throne. Palance always realized this, of course, but it divided us as we grew older, mainly because his ideas of ruling the land were not always the same as mine. It's difficult to explain, you understand."
"It's not so difficult," Hendel snorted meaningfully. "All right, then it's not so difficult," Balinor conceded wearily, to which Hendel responded with a knowing nod. "Palance believes Callahorn should cease to serve as a first line of defense in case of attack on the Southland people. He wants to disband the Border Legion and isolate Callahorn from the rest of the Southland. We cannot agree at all on this point." He trailed off in bitter silence for a moment. "Tell them the rest, Balinor." Hendel again spoke icily. "My distrustful friend believes my brother is no longer his own master, that he says these things without meaning them. He keeps counsel with a mystic known as Stenman, a man Al-Anon feels is without honor and will guide Palance to his own destruction. Stenman has told my father and the people that my brother should rule, and not I. He has turned him against me. When I left, even Palance seemed to believe that I was not fit to rule Callahorn."
"And that scar?" Durin asked quietly.
"An argument we had just before I left with Al-Anon," Balinor replied, shaking his head as he thought back on the matter. "I can't even remember how it started. But all at once, Palance was in a rage. There was real hatred in his eyes. I turned to leave and he grabbed a whip from the wall, striking out at me, cutting into my face with the tip. That was the reason I decided to get away from Tirsis for a time, to give Palance a chance to regain his senses. If I had stayed after that incident, we might have... Again he trailed off ominously, and Hendel shot the elven brothers a glance that left no doubt in their minds what would have happened if the brothers had had another altercation. Durin frowned in disbelief, wondering what sort of person would take sides against a man like Balinor. The tall border man had repeatedly proved his courage and strength of character during their dangerous journey to Perrinor, and even Alanon had relied heavily on him. Yet his brother had deliberately and vindictively turned against him. The elf felt a deep sadness for this brave warrior, returned to a homeland where peace even in his own family was denied him. "You must believe me when I tell you that my brother was not always like that. Nor do I believe he is now a bad man," Balinor continued, more as if he were explaining it to himself than to the others. "This mystic Stenman has some kind of hold over Palance that provokes him into these rages, turning him against me and what he knows to be right." "There is more to him than that," Hendel interrupted sharply. "Palance is an idealistic fanatic. He seeks the throne and turns against you under pretext of upholding the interests of the people. He is choking on his own self-righteousness." "Perhaps you are right, Hendel," Balinor conceded quietly. "But he is still my brother, and I love him." "That's what makes him so dangerous," the dwarf declared, standing before the tall borderman, meeting his gaze squarely. "He no longer loves you." Balinor did not reply, but stared into the plainlands to the west and toward the city of Tirsis. The others remained silent for a few minutes, leaving the brooding prince to his own thoughts. Finally he turned back to them, his face relaxed and calm, looking as if the whole matter had never come up. "Time to be moving on. We want to reach the walls of the city before nightfall." "I'm going no farther with you, Balinor," Hendel interjected quickly. "I must return to my own land and help prepare the dwarf armies against an invasion of the Anar."
"Well, you can rest in Tirsis for tonight and leave tomorrow," Dale replied quickly, knowing how tired they all were and anxious for the dwarf's safety. Hendel smiled patiently, then shook his head.
"No, I must travel at night in these lands. If I stay the night in Tirsis, I lose a whole day's travel, and time is very precious to us all. The entire Southland stands or falls on how quickly we can assemble our armies into a combined fighting unit to strike back at the Warlock Lord. If Shae and the Sword of Shannara are lost to us, then our armies are all we have left. I will travel to Varfleet and rest there. Take care, my friends. Luck to you in the days ahead."
"And to you, brave Hendel." Balinor extended a great hand. Hendel clasped it warmly, then those of the elven brothers, and disappeared into the forests with a parting wave. Balinor and the elven brothers waited until they could no longer see him moving through the trees, and then began their walk across the plains toward Tirsis. The sun had dropped behind the horizon, and the sky had turned from dusky red to a deep gray and blue that signaled the momentary approach of night. They were about halfway when the sky turned completely black, revealing the first of the night's stars shining in a clear, cloudless sky. As they neared the fabled city, its vast bulk sprawling and dark against the night horizon, the Prince of Calahorn described in detail to the elven brothers the history behind the building of Tirsis. A series of natural defenses protected the man-made fortress. The city had been built on a high plateau which ran back against a line of small but treacherous cliffs. The cliffs bounded the plateau entirely on the south and partially on the west and east. While they were not nearly so high or formidable in appearance as the Dragon's Teeth or the Charnel Mountains of the far Northland, they were incredibly steep. That portion of the cliffs that faced north onto the plateau rose almost straight up, and no one had ever successfully scaled it. Thus the city was well protected from the rear, and it had never been necessary to construct any defenses to the south.
The plateau on which the city was built was a little over 3 miles across at its widest point, dropping off sharply onto the plainlands, which ran unbroken and open all the way north and west to the Myrmidon River, and east to the forests of Calahorn. The swift Myrmidon actually formed the first line of defense against invasion, and few armies had ever gotten beyond that point to reach the plateau and the city walls. The enemy who did manage to cross the Myrmidon onto the plainlands immediately found itself confronted by the steep wall of the plateau, which could be defended from above. The main route of access to this bluff was a huge iron and stone rampway, which was rigged to collapse by knocking out pins in the major supports. But even if the enemy managed to reach the top of the plateau and thereby gain a foothold, the third defense waited. The defense that no army had ever broken through. Standing a scant 200 yards from the edge of the plateau and ringing the entire city in a semicircle, the ends reaching back to the cliff sides protecting the southern approach, was the monstrous outer wall. Constructed from great blocks of stone welded together with mortar, the surface had been smoothed down to make scaling by hand virtually impossible. It rose nearly 100 feet into the air, massive, towering, impregnable. At the top of the wall, ramparts had been built for the men fighting within the city, with sections cut away to allow concealed bowmen room to shoot down on the unprotected attackers. It was ancient in styling, crude and rough-hewn, but it had repelled invaders for almost 1,000 years. No enemy army had penetrated into the inner city since its construction following the First War of the Races. Just within the great outer wall, the Border Legion was quartered in a series of long, sloping barracks, interspersed by buildings used for storage of supplies and weapons. Approximately 1/3 of this great fighting force was kept on duty at any given time, while the other 2/3 remained at home with their families, pursuing their secondary occupations as laborers, craftsmen, or shopkeepers in the city. The barracks were equipped to house the entire army if the need should ever arise, as indeed it had already done on more than one occasion, but at present they were only partially filled. Set back from the barracks, supply housing and parade grounds was a second wall of stone blocks separating the soldiers' quarters from the city proper. Within this second wall, lining the neat, winding city streets, were the homes and businesses of the urban population of Tirsis, all carefully constructed and meticulously cared for buildings. The city sprawled over most of the plateau's elevation, running from this second stone wall almost to the cliffs bordering the south approach. At this innermost point of the city, a low third wall had been built which marked the entrance to the government buildings and the royal palace of the king, complete with public forum and landscaped grounds. The tree-shaded parks surrounding the palace provided the only sylvan setting on the otherwise open and sparse flatland of the plateau. The third wall had not been built for defensive purposes, but as a line of demarcation, signifying government-owned property that had been reserved for the king's use, and, in the case of the parks, for all the people. Balinor deviated from his description of the city's construction long enough to point out to the Elven brothers that the Kingdom of Calahorn was one of the few remaining enlightened monarchies in the world. While it was technically a monarchy ruled by a king, the government also consisted of a parliamentary body composed of representatives chosen by the people of Calahorn, who helped the ruler hammer out the laws that governed the land. The people took great pride in their government and in the Border Legion in which most either had served at one time or were serving now. It was a country in which they could be free men, and this was something worth fighting for. Calahorn was a land that reflected both the past and the future. On the one hand, its cities had been built primarily as fortresses to withstand the frequent assaults by warlike neighbors. The Border Legion was a carryover from earlier times when the newly formed nations were constantly at war, when an almost fanatical pride in national sovereignty resulted in a long struggle over jealously guarded land boundaries, when brotherhood between the peoples of the four lands was still only a distant possibility. The rustic, old-fashioned decor and architecture could be found nowhere else in the quickly growing cities of the Deep Southland. Cities where more enlightened cultures and less warlike policies were beginning to prevail. Yet it was Tirsis, with her barbaric walls of stone and warrior men of iron, that had shielded the lower Southland and given it that chance to expand in new directions. There were signs of what was to come in this picturesque land as well, signs that told of another age and time not too far distant. There was a unity of expression in the people that spoke of tolerance and understanding of all races and peoples. In Callahorn, as in no other country in all the sheltered Southland, a man was accepted for what he was and treated accordingly. Tirsis was the crossroads of the four lands, and through its walls and lands passed members of all the nations, giving its people an opportunity to see and understand that the differences in face and body that distinguished the races outwardly were negligible. It was the inner person the people had learned to judge. A giant rock troll would not be stared at and shunned because of his grotesque appearance by the people of Callahorn. Trolls were common in that land. Gnomes, elves, and dwarves of all types and species made regular passages through that country, and if they were friends, they were welcomed. Balinor smiled as he spoke of this new, growing phenomenon that had begun at last to spread to all the lands, and he felt proud that his people were among the first to turn from the old prejudices to look for common grounds of understanding and friendship. Durin and Dale listened in silent agreement. The elven people knew what it was like to be alone in a world of people who couldn't see beyond their own limits. Balinor had finished, and the three comrades swung from the tall grass of the plainland onto a broad roadway. The road wound ahead into the darkness toward the low, squat plateau looming blackly against the horizon. They were close enough now to make out the lights of the sprawling city and the movement of people on the stone ramp. The entrance through the towering outer wall was sharply outlined by torchlight, the giant gates standing open on oiled hinges, guarded by a number of dark-garbed sentries. From the courtyard within shone the lights of the barracks, but there was an absence of men's laughter and joking that Balinor found peculiar. The voices that were audible were hushed, even muffled, as if no one wished to be heard. The tall borderman peered ahead watchfully, suddenly concerned that something was amiss, but he could detect nothing out of the ordinary, aside from the unusual silence. He dismissed the matter from his mind. The elven brothers followed wordlessly as the determined Balinor mounted the causeway leading to the darkened bluff. Several people passed them as they climbed, and those who looked carefully turned to stare in open shock at the Prince of Callahorn. Balinor failed to acknowledge these strange looks, intent upon the city ahead, but the brothers missed nothing and looked at each other in silent warning. Something was seriously wrong. Moments later, as the three reached the plateau, Balinor too stopped in sudden concern. He peered intently toward the gates of the city, then looked about him at the shadowed faces of the people passing, who scattered quickly and wordlessly into the night upon discovering his identity. For a moment the three stood rooted in silence, watching the few remaining passers-by disappear into the darkness, leaving them alone. "What is it, Balinor?" Durin asked at last. "I'm not certain," the prince replied anxiously. "Look at the insignia of those guards at the gate. None of them bear the crest of the leopard, the standard of my border legion. Instead, they wear the sign of a falcon, a mark I do not recognize. The people, too. Did you notice their looks?
The slim elven faces nodded as one, the keen slanted eyes casting about in undisguised apprehension.
No matter, the border man declared shortly. This is still my father's city, and these are my people. We'll get to the bottom of this when we reach the palace.
Again he started toward the mammoth gates of the outer wall, the elves a step or two behind him. The tall prince made no effort to hide his face as he approached the four armed guards, and their reaction was the same as that of the astonished passers-by. They made no move to stop the prince, and no words passed between them. Yet one hurriedly abandoned his post and disappeared quickly through the gates of the inner wall into the streets of the city beyond. Balinor and the elves passed beneath the shadow of the giant gateway, which seemed to hang in the darkness above them like a monstrous stone arm. They moved past the open gates and the watchful guards into the courtyard beyond, where they could see the low, Spartan-like barracks that housed the famed Border Legion. There were few lights burning, and the barracks appeared to be nearly deserted. A few men scattered about the courtyard wore tunics bearing the insignia of the leopard, but they wore no armor and carried no weapons. One stared momentarily as the three paused in the center of the courtyard, then started in disbelief and cried out sharply to his fellow soldiers. A door burst open from one of the barracks and a grizzled veteran appeared, staring with the others at Balinor and the elven brothers. He gave a short command, and the soldiers reluctantly turned back to whatever they had been doing, while he hastened over to the three newcomers.
"My lord Balinor, you've come at last," the soldier exclaimed in greeting, his head bowing briefly as he came to attention before his commander.
"Captain Shelon, it's good to see you."
Balinor clasped the veteran's gnarled hand in his own.
"What's going on in the city? Why do the guards wear the sign of a falcon and not that of our fighting leopard?"
"My lord, the Border Legion has been ordered to disband. Only a handful of us still remain on duty. The rest to return to their homes."
They stared at the man as if he were insane. The Border Legion had been disbanded in the midst of the greatest invasion ever to threaten the Southland? Almost as one, they recalled the words of Alanon telling them that the Border Legion was the only hope left to the people of the threatened lands, that the Border Legion must at least temporarily delay the awesome force assembled by the Warlock Lord. Now the army of Calahorn had been mysteriously scattered. "By whose order?" Balinor asked in slow fury.
"It was your brother," the grizzled Shelon declared quickly. "He ordered his own guardsmen to assume our duties and commanded the Legion to disband until further notice. The lords Acton and Messaline went to the palace to beg the king to reconsider, but they did not return. There was nothing more any of us could do but obey."
"Has everyone gone mad?" the infuriated borderman demanded, clasping the soldier's tunic.
"What of my father, the king? Does he not still rule this land and command the Border Legion? What does he say of this fool's play?"
Shelon looked away, groping for the words to the answer he was afraid to speak. Balinor jerked him around violently.
I do not know, my lord," the man muttered, still trying to turn away. "We heard the king was ill, and then there was nothing more. Your brother declared himself temporary ruler in the king's absence from the throne. That was 3 weeks ago."
Balinor released the man in shocked silence and stared absently at the lights of the distant palace, the home he had come back to with such great hopes. He had left Calahorn because of an intolerable rift between his brother and himself, yet his going had only made matters worse. Now he must face the unpredictable Palance on terms not of his own choosing. Face him and persuade him somehow of the folly of his action in disbanding the desperately needed Border Legion.
"We must go at once to the palace and speak with your brother."
The eager, impatient voice of Dale cut into his thoughts. He looked at the youthful elf for a moment, reminded suddenly of his own brother's young age. It was going to be so hard to reason with Palance.
Yes. You're right, of course, he agreed almost absently. We must go to him.
No, you mustn't go in there.
The sharp cry of Shelon held them rooted in place.
The others who went did not come out again. There are rumors that your brother has declared you a traitor, found you to be in league with the evil Alanon, the black wanderer who serves the dark powers. It has been said that you shall be imprisoned and put to death.
That is ridiculous, exclaimed the tall borderman quickly. I am no traitor, and even my brother knows this to be true. As for Alanon, he is the best friend and ally the Southland will ever find. I must go to Palance and speak with him. We may disagree, but he would not imprison his own brother. The power is not his.
Unless, perhaps, your father is dead, my friend, Durin cautioned from one side. The time to be prudent is now, before we have entered the palace grounds. Hendel believes your brother to be under the influence of the mystic Stenman, and if he is, you may be in greater danger than you realize.
Balinor paused, then nodded his agreement. Quickly he explained to Shelon the threat to Callahorn of an impending Northland invasion, emphasizing his belief that the Border Legion would be vital to the defense of their homeland. Then he gripped the aged soldier's shoulder tightly and bent close to him. You will wait 4 hours for my return or for my personal messenger. If I have not come out or sent word in that time, you will seek out the Lords Jinison and Fandwick. The Border Legion needs to be reassembled immediately. Then go to the people and demand an open trial of our cause from my brother. He cannot refuse this. You will also send word west and east to the elf and dwarf nations, informing them that we are thus held, both I and the cousins of Eventine. Can you remember all I have said to you?
Yes, my lord.
The soldier nodded eagerly. It shall be done as you command. May fortune go with you, Prince of Callahorn. He turned and disappeared back into the barracks, while an impatient and angry Balinor moved toward the inner city. Once again, Durin whispered to his younger brother, urging him to remain outside the city walls until he knew what would happen to Balinor and himself, but Dale stubbornly refused to be left behind. Durin knew it was pointless to argue the matter further, and at last conceded Dale's right to go along. The slim elf had not yet reached his 20th year, and for him life was just beginning. All of the members of the little company that had come from Cullhaven had felt a special kind of affection for Dale, the protective love that close friends always feel for the youngest. His fresh candor and ready friendship were rare qualities in a time when most men lived lives hemmed in by suspicion and distrust. Durin was afraid for him, for he had the most to look ahead to and the fewest years behind. If the boy were harmed in any way, he realized that an irreplaceable part of himself would be lost. Durin watched his brother in silence as the lights of Tirsis burned through the darkness ahead. In moments, the three crossed the courtyard and passed through the gates of the inner wall to the streets of the city beyond. Once more the guards stared in open amazement, but again they did not move to stop the travelers from entering. Balinor seemed to grow in size as the three proceeded down the Tirsian Way, the main city thoroughfare, his dark form wrapped ominously in the hunting cloak, the chainmail glinting from exposed fists and neck. He stood taller than before, no longer the weary traveler at his journey's end, but the Prince of Callahorn come home. The people knew him at once, at first stopping and staring like those at the outer gates, then gathering heart from his proud bearing and rushing after him, eager to welcome him home. The crowd swelled from a few dozen to several hundred as the favorite son of Callahorn strode boldly through the city, smiling to those who followed, but hastening to reach the palace. The shouts and cries of the people rose deafeningly, changing from scattered voices to a single rising chant, calling the tall borderman's name.
A few of the crowd managed to get next to the determined man, whispering ominous warnings. But the prince would not listen to cautious voices any longer. Shaking his head after each warning, he continued on. The growing crowd passed through the heart of Tirsis, milling under the giant archways and crosswalks that ran overhead, pushing through the narrow portions of the Tirsian Way past tall, white-walled buildings and smaller single-family residences to the Bridge of Sendik, which spanned the lower levels of the people's parks. At the other end stood the gates of the palace, darkened and closed. At the peak of the bridge's wide arch, the Prince of Calahorn turned abruptly to face the throng still faithfully following him and threw up his hands in a command to halt. They came to an obedient stop, their voices lowering into silence as the tall figure addressed them. "My friends, my countrymen," the proud voice rang out in the near darkness, its thundering echoes rolling back. "I've missed this land and its brave citizens, but I have come home, and I will not leave again. There is no need for fear. This land shall stand eternal. If there be trouble within the monarchy, then it is for me to face it. You must go back now to your homes and wait for morning to show you in a better light that all is well. Please, go now to your homes, and I shall go to mine." Without waiting to judge the crowd's reaction, Balinor wheeled about and proceeded on across the bridge toward the gates of the palace, the elven brothers still close at his heels. The voice of the people rose again to call after them, but the crowd did not follow, though many might have wished to do so. Obedient to his command, they turned slowly about, some still shouting his name in defiance at the silent, darkened castle, though others mumbled grim prophecies of what awaited the tall borderman and his two friends within the walls of the imperial home. The three travelers quickly lost sight of the people as they started down the slope of the bridge's high arch in quick, determined strides. In minutes they reached the tall, metal-bound gates of the Palace of the Buckhannas. Balinor never paused, but reached for the huge iron ring fastened to the wood and brought it crashing down against the shuttered gate in thundering knocks. For a moment there was no other sound, as the men stood in the darkness without, listening with mixed feelings of anger and apprehension. Then a low voice from within called for identification. Balinor gave his name and a sharp command to those within to open the gates immediately. In an instant, the heavy bars were drawn back and the gates swung inward to admit the three. Balinor moved into the garden courtyard without a backward glance at the silent guards, his eyes on the magnificent columned building beyond. Its high windows were dark except for those on the ground floor in the left wing. Durin motioned Dale ahead of him, taking the opportunity to peer into the shadows about them where he quickly discovered a dozen well-armed guards close at hand. All bore the insignia of the Falcon. The watchful elf knew instantly that they were walking into a trap, just as he had silently anticipated when they had entered the city. His first inclination was to stop Balinor and warn him of what he had seen, but he instinctively knew that the borderman was far too seasoned a fighter not to know what he was getting into. Durin wished once more that his brother had stayed outside the palace walls, but it was too late now. The three crossed the garden walks to the doors of the palace. There were no guards, and the doors opened without resistance to Balinor's hurried shove. The halls of the aged building glowed brightly in the torchlight, the flames catching the splendor of the colorful wall murals and paintings that decorated the Buckhanna family home. The wood trimming was old and rich, polished with care and partially covered by fine tapestries and metal plaques of family crests from generations of the famed rulers of the land. As the elven brothers followed the tall prince down these silent halls, they recalled darkly another time and place in the recent past, the ancient fortress of Perenor.
There, too, a trap had awaited them amid the historic splendor of another age. They turned left into another hallway, Balinor still in the lead by several strides, his big form filling the high corridor, the long hunting cloak billowing out behind him as he walked. For an instant he reminded Durin of Alanon, huge, angered, dangerous when he moved cat-like as the Prince of Calahorn did now. Durin glanced anxiously at Dale, but the younger elf did not seem to notice. His face was flushed with excitement. Durin felt for the handle of his dagger, the cold metal reassuring to his hot palm. If they were to be trapped again, it would not be without a fight. Then the giant borderman stopped suddenly before an open doorway. The elven brothers hastened to his side, peering past his broad frame into the lighted room beyond. There was a man standing near the back of the elegantly furnished chamber. A big man, blonde and bearded, his broad figure cloaked in a long purple robe with a falcon marking. He was several years younger than Balinor, but held his tall frame erect in the same manner, the hands clasped loosely behind his back. The elves knew immediately that he was Palance Buckhanna. Balinor moved several steps into the chamber, saying nothing, his eyes riveted on his brother's face. The elves followed the borderman, looking cautiously about. There were too many doors, too many heavy drapes that could be concealing armed guards. A moment later there was a movement in the hall behind them just out of sight. Dale turned slightly to face the open doorway. Durin moved a little apart from the others, his long hunting knife drawn, his lean frame bent slightly in a half-crouch. Balinor made no move but stood silently before his brother, staring at the familiar face, amazed that the eyes were filled with a strange hatred. He had known it would be a trap, known that his brother would be prepared for them. Yet he had believed all along that they would at least be able to talk as brothers, converse with one another in a frank and reasonable manner despite their differences. But as he looked into those eyes and caught the undisguised glint of burning fury, he realized that his brother was beyond reason, perhaps beyond sanity. "Where is my father?" Balinor's abrupt query was cut short by a sudden swishing sound, as hidden cords released a large leather and rope net that had hung unnoticed above the intruders, dropping it instantly over all three. The attached weights brought all of them crashing to the floor in staggered dismay, their weapons useless against the toughened cords. Doors flew open from all sides, and the heavy drapes whipped back as several dozen armed guards rushed over to subdue the struggling captives. There was never any chance to escape the carefully prepared trap, never even a momentary opportunity to fight back. The captives were relieved of their weapons, their hands bound unceremoniously behind their backs and their eyes blindfolded. They were lifted roughly to their feet and firmly held in place by a dozen unseen hands. There was momentary silence as someone approached and stood before them. "You were a fool to come back, Balinor," a chilling voice sounded out of the blackness. "You knew what would happen to you if I found you again. You are thrice over a traitor and a coward for what you have done. To the people, to my father, and now even to me. What have you done with Shirl? What have you done with her? You will die for this, Balinor, I swear it. Take them below." The hands spun them about, shoving and dragging them down the hallway, through one door, down a long flight of stairs to a landing and another hall that wound about in a maze of twists and turns. Their feet thudded heavily on dank stones in a black, unbroken silence. Suddenly they were going down yet another set of stairs and into another passageway. They could smell the stale, chill air and feel the dampness ooze from the stone walls and floor.
A set of heavy bolts was drawn slowly back with a screech of aged iron against iron, and the door they held in place ponderously opened. The hands turned them sharply, releasing them without warning as they fell, dazed and battered to the stone floor, still bound and blindfolded. The door closed and the bolts slid heavily into place. The three companions listened wordlessly. They heard the sound of footsteps retreating rapidly into the distance until they had faded away altogether. They heard the sounds of clanging metal as doors were barred and shuttered, each farther away than the last, until finally there was only the sound of their own breathing in the deep silence of their prison. Balinor had come home.
Chapter 23. It was nearing midnight by the time Alanon had finished disguising the reluctant Flick to his satisfaction. Using a strange lotion produced from a pouch he carried at his waist, the druid rubbed the skin of the Veilman's face and hands until it was a dark yellow. A piece of soft coal altered the lines in the face and the appearance of the eyes. It was a makeshift job at best, but in the dark he could pass for a large, heavy-set gnome, if not closely examined. It would have been a perilous undertaking even for a seasoned hunter, and for an untrained man to attempt to pass himself off as a gnome appeared to be suicide. But there was no alternative left. Someone had to get into that giant encampment and attempt to discover what had happened to Eventine, Shay, and the elusive sword. It was out of the question for Alanon to go down there. He would have been recognized in an instant, even in the best disguise. So the task fell to the frightened Flick, disguised as a gnome, under cover of darkness, to work his way down the slopes, past the watching guards, into the camp occupied by thousands of gnomes and trolls, and there find out if his brother or the missing elven king were prisoners, in addition to trying to learn something of the whereabouts of the sword. To complicate matters, the Veilman had to get clear of the enemy camp before daybreak. If he failed to do this, someone would most certainly see through his disguise in the daylight and he would be caught. Alanon asked Flick to remove his hunting cloak and worked on the material for several minutes, altering the cut slightly and lengthening the hood covering to conceal its wearer better. When he was done, Flick covered himself and found that with the cloak pulled closely about his body, nothing was visible aside from his hands and a shadowed portion of his face. If he stayed away from any true gnomes and kept moving until dawn, there was an outside chance that he might learn something important and still escape to tell Alanon. He checked to be certain the short hunting dagger was securely fastened to his waist. It was a poor substitute for a weapon, should he have need of one once he was within the encampment, but it gave him a little reassurance that he was not totally without protection. He stood up slowly, his short, heavy-set frame wrapped in the cloak as Alanon looked him over carefully, and then nodded. The weather had become threatening during the past hour, the sky a solid bank of rolling, blackened clouds that completely blotted out the moon and stars, leaving the earth in almost complete darkness. The only visible light in any direction came from the blazing fires of the encamped enemy, the flames rushing higher with the sudden appearance of a strong north wind that howled fiercely through the dragon's teeth to sweep in rising gusts onto the unprotected plainlands below. A storm was on the way, and it would very likely reach them before morning. The silent druid was hopeful that the winds and darkness would offer the disguised Veilman a little added cover from the eyes of the sleeping army. In brief, clipped sentences, the giant mystic offered Flick a few parting words of caution. He explained the manner in which the camp would be arranged, noting the pattern in which the guards would be posted about the perimeter of the main army. He told him to look for the standards of the gnome chieftains and the Moterans, the troll leaders, which would undoubtedly lie somewhere near the center of the fires.
At all costs, he was to avoid speaking to anyone, for the tone of his voice would instantly betray him as a Southlander. Flick listened attentively, his heart pounding wildly as he waited to go, his own mind already made up that he had no chance of escaping detection. But his loyalty to his brother was too great to permit the interference of common sense when Shay's safety was threatened. Al-Anon closed his brief explanation by promising to see that the youth got safely past the first guard line that had been posted at the base of these slopes. He signaled for complete silence, then motioned for the other to follow. They moved down out of the rocky shelter of the high boulders, winding their way through the darkness toward the open plain. It was so black that Flick could see almost nothing and had to be led by the hand in order to stay with the sure-footed druid. It seemed to take an interminable length of time for the two to reach an exit point from the twisting maze of boulders, but at last they were able to see once more the fires of the enemy camp burning in the darkness ahead. Flick was bruised and battered from his climb down out of the mountain heights, his limbs aching from the strain, his cloak torn in several places. The darkness of the plain seemed to stand like an unbroken wall between the fires and themselves, and Flick could neither see nor hear the guard lines he knew were there. Al-Anon said nothing, but crouched back in the shelter of the rocks, his head cocked slightly as he listened. The two remained motionless for long minutes, then suddenly Al-Anon rose, motioning Flick to remain where he was, and silently disappeared in the night. When he was gone, the little Veilman looked about anxiously, alone and frightened because he had no idea what was happening. Leaning his heated face against the cool surface of the rock, he went over in his mind what he would do once he reached the encampment. He didn't have much of a plan to rely on. He would avoid speaking with anyone, and if possible, avoid passing close to anyone. He would stay clear of the illuminating firelight which might betray his poor disguise. The prisoners, if in the camp at all, would be held in a guarded tent near the center of the fires, so his first objective would be to find that tent. Once he found it, he would try to get a look inside to see who was there. Then, assuming he got that far, which seemed highly unlikely, he would make his way back to the slopes, where Al-Anon would be waiting, and they would decide their next move. Flick shook his head in frustration. He knew he would never be able to get away with this disguise. He was neither talented nor clever enough to fool anyone. But ever since losing Shay over the side of the Dragon's Crease days earlier, his attitude had completely altered, and the old pessimism and hard-nosed practicality had been replaced by a strange sense of futile desperation. His familiar world had altered so drastically in the past few weeks that he no longer seemed capable of identifying with his old values and sensible practices. Time had become almost meaningless in the punishing, endless days of running and hiding, of fighting creatures that belonged to another world. The years spent living and growing in the peace and solitude of Shady Vale were distant, forgotten days of an early youth. The only constant forces in his upended life of the past weeks had been his companions, particularly his brother. Now they too had been scattered one by one, until at last Flick stood alone, on the verge of exhaustion and mental collapse, his world a mad, impossible puzzle of nightmares and spirits that chased and haunted him to the brink of despair. The hulking presence of Al-Anon had given him little comfort. The giant druid had remained from their first meeting both an impenetrable wall of secrecy and a mystical force with powers that defied explanation. Despite the growing camaraderie of the company on the journey to Paranor and beyond, the druid had remained aloof and secretive. Even what he had told them about his own origin and purposes did little to lighten the dark veil of mystery in which he had wrapped himself.
When the company had been together, the mystic's domination of them had not seemed so overpowering, even though he had remained the undisputed force behind their hazardous search for the Sword of Shannara. But now, with the others gone, leaving the frightened Veilman alone with this unpredictable giant, Flick found himself unable to escape that terrible awesomeness that formed the essence of this strange man. He thought back again on the mysterious tale of the history of the fabled sword, and again he remembered Al-Anon's refusal to tell the members of the little company the whole story behind its power. They had risked everything for that elusive talisman, and still no one but Al-Anon knew how the weapon could be used to defeat the warlock lord. Why was it that Al-Anon knew so much about it? A sudden noise in the darkness behind him brought the terrified Veilman about in a flash, the short hunting knife drawn and extended in self-defense. There was a sharp whisper, and the huge form of Al-Anon moved silently to Flick's side. A powerful hand gripped his shoulder, guiding him back into the shelter of the rock-covered slope, where the two crouched cautiously in the blackness. Al-Anon studied the Veilman's face for an instant as if judging his courage, reading his mind to see the nature of his thoughts. Flick could just barely force himself to meet the penetrating gaze, his heart pounding in mingled fear and excitement. "The guards are disposed of. The way is clear." The deep voice seemed to rise up out of the depths of the earth. "Go now, my young friend, and keep your courage and your good sense close at hand." Flick nodded shortly and rose, his cloak-shrouded form gliding quickly and stealthily out of the cover of the boulders onto the blackness of the empty plains. His mind ceased to reason, ceased to wonder as his body took command and his instincts probed the darkness for hidden danger. He moved swiftly toward the distant firelight, running in a half-crouch, pausing occasionally to check his position and listen for the sounds of human movement. The night was an impenetrable shroud all about him, the sky still heavily overcast and wrapped in a huge cloud blanket that shut out even the dim whiteness of the moon and stars. The only light came from the campfires ahead. The plainland was smooth and open, its surface a grassy blanket that muffled the Veilman's footfalls as he raced silently forward. There were few bushes to break the pattern, and it was left to one or two thin, twisted trees to fill the vast emptiness. There was no sign of life anywhere in the darkness, and the only sounds were the muffled howl of the rising wind and his own heavy breathing. The campfires that had formerly seemed a low haze of orange light from the base of the mountains spread apart into individual fires as the Veilman drew closer, some burning brightly, their flames well fed on new wood, while others had dimmed and nearly died into coals as the men who tended them slept undisturbed. Flick was close enough now to hear the faint sound of voices in the sleeping camp, but they were not distinct enough to enable him to make out the words. Almost half an hour passed before Flick reached the outer perimeter of the enemy fires. He paused in a crouch just beyond the light to study the lay of the camp ahead. The cool night wind blowing out of the north fanned the crackling flames of the large wood fires, sending thin clouds of smoke swirling across the open plains toward the Veilman. There was a second ring of sentries encircling the encampment, but it was only a secondary guard line loosely set at wide intervals. The Northlanders felt there was little need for caution this close to the campsite. The sentries were primarily gnome hunters, although Flick could distinguish the larger bulks of troll men scattered about as well. He paused momentarily to study the strange, unfamiliar features of the trolls. They were of different sizes, all thick-limbed and covered with a dark, wood-like skin that appeared rough and highly protective. The sentries and the few members of the army that were not asleep, but standing idly about or crouched near the low-burning fires for warmth, had wrapped themselves in heavy cloaks that masked most of their bodies and faces.
Flick nodded to himself in satisfaction. It would be easier for him to slip into the camp undetected if everyone remained wrapped in their cloaks,